Hello, and welcome to the Laughing Place podcast. We're so glad to be back here today. My name is Doobie, and to my left we have Captain John.
Arr, Captain John.
And across from me is Fanboy.
Hello.
That's it?
I got nothing.
To my right is my talented and lovely wife, Rebecca.
NASCAR on ESPN coming soon. Woohoo!
Did I mention she's a redneck? And as I said, I'm Doobie, and before we get started, as always, we want to give a plug to feedback, because we love to hear from you, and we're so excited we actually got feedback this week. We're going to be playing it later. So
it's funny, in this internet age, it's like feedback, that's like a good thing. And like growing up, I mean, I studied like, you know, mass comm in college, and feedback, you didn't want feedback when you were doing radio. When you had a microphone in front of you, feedback, this was not a good word.
Oh, you mean... I'm with you now. That was humor. I didn't know you were being funny. I thought Fanboy was in charge of funny.
Sorry.
Okay. Where was I? Oh, we want to hear from you. podcast@laughingplace.com for email. There's a section on our discussion boards to talk to us, and there's a couple discussions going on there we'd love to get your input on. And toll-free, we pay the bill, 866-718-9408. We especially want to hear from you this week on what you think is the best Disney attraction of all time. If you heard our show last week, you heard Rebecca make the mistake of saying Splash Mountain was better than Indiana Jones. And I think Fanboy and I corrected her on that. We've gotten some other feedback already correcting her on that. We'd like to keep the corrections coming. So if you agree with us, or even if you agree with my lovely wife, Rebecca, please let us know, 866-718-9408. We want to know your favorite, not your favorite, what you think the best Disney attraction of all time is and why. So...
yeah, prove that, Doobie and Fanboy wrong,
and,
please.
And that's how Doobie celebrated Valentine's Day, by correcting Rebecca the whole time, playing podcast voicemails saying, Rebecca's wrong, Rebecca's wrong. So that's the kind of love their relationship's built out of.
It's a deep love. It's not that superficial stuff you see in these Disney movies. It goes beyond that.
Yeah, touch-tone Miramax level.
Let's get started. Fanboy, you're up. Let's talk about that big investors conference a couple weeks ago. A
couple weeks, as in last week. on Wednesday and Thursday, Disney held their annual investor conference for folks in the investor community, the ones that they really want to wine and dine, people that control mutual funds with lots of stock. It was held at the Boardwalk here at Walt Disney World, with segments, obviously, at Pleasure Island, namely so they can show movies, and a party at Animal Kingdom, because... what's an investor conference without liquor at Animal Kingdom? And so the day started off on Thursday with earnings, and for the first quarter of the fiscal year, they were stellar, especially if you discount the fact that we just made a bunch of money by selling things like E! Television and Us Weekly. And then they went to Animal Kingdom, and Jay Rizzullo got a lot of buzz for talking about extending the theme parks division outside of theme parks. I mean, you've seen it with Adventures by Disney and the Cruise Line. I know, you know, the Dick Nunes, Michael Eisner era was all about sort of taking the existing properties and adding more parks and stuff. I mean, Disney World from 95 on, you know, was all about that. And then, I'm sorry, 89 to about 95. And then, you know, they built two parks in every destination with mixed success. But now it's more about how do they take Disney Parks and Resorts and extend that beyond the theme parks. You saw that with start with the Cruise Line in 98. And he talked about things that may or may not happen. I don't want to get anyone too excited. But like themed hotels in urban areas and other destinations, downtown Disney malls across the country and the world, water parks not associated with a Disney theme park, niche parks, kind of if you're familiar with Discovery Cove, which is sort of a limited number of people providing an intimate experience.
Would the niche parks be at a separate location as well, or at existing
properties? It could be both. You kind of get the idea that they're looking outside of existing properties, but I wouldn't be surprised if they sort of test it at, like, Walt Disney World, like they did with Disney Quest, to that stellar success as well.
Okay.
So I don't know. It's neat to – it was really – you know, I know that we had the press event earlier in the month, and we were kind of waiting for Jay to kind of make his – statement as where he sees the business going, and it didn't happen, but I really think that this was his chance to do it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Not all of this, at least it seems to me, is totally new. I mean, this would not be the first time Disney tried to do Disney outside of the theme parks. For example, there was Club Disney and, of course, Disney Quest.
Well, but I think that was a different idea of what they're doing. I think they're trying to take the Disney architecture and the Disney quality and do that outside of the Disney theme parks, not just take the brand and open a glorified Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, if you look at, you know, I know Rebecca took a tour of the Cinderella Castle, or if you go on the Disney Magic, that's what they're looking for, those details, the high-quality experience as opposed to just a branded experience. And I think that's the difference.
Hearing this move towards locations outside of the theme park region to, like, the malls or whatnot, I was thinking it makes me want to go visit the DVC locations that are outside of Walt Disney World. It makes me want to go check out Vero Beach and go check out Hilton Head, because I'm wondering if that might give me a better feeling of what they might do. I don't know how Disney-fied those particular locations are, but Fanboy pointed out that I thought exactly immediately of the castle suite when I heard about these ideas, because I just thought that those were really incredible, and they had that Disney magic and the Disney quality, and that's something that could be transported to a location even outside. There's more magical to the Cinderella castle suite than the location. The location is just one element of why that works.
I think also if you go to the Encounter restaurant at LAX, if you're flying into LAX or go to Disneyland or you're a local down there, check it out, because it's definitely, you can see the Disney in it without having anything to do with Disney. It's not run by Disney. It's not operated by Disney. It's not Disney themed.
Do you think that's more, though, than what Jay's talking about, Jay Rizzullo's talking about, of Disney just basically doing stuff for other people? Because when I went to Encounter, there was nothing to indicate I was at a Disney location.
Right, and I think you're looking at both. He mentions specifically they're looking at private equity outside of Disney, and also Disney, if it makes sense. You know, the whole company is always looking at, is it better to license or is it better to do it internally? And I think it's going to be a case-by-case thing. But I think that kind of attitude is, you're not going to go to some of these new hotels and be like the Pop Century or just – Disney everywhere. It's going to be more like the Grand Californian, just happens to be Disney owned. I mean, not saying there won't be any character presence or character dining or anything like that, but it won't be as Disney as Disney Quest and Club Disney were.
And I think this fits back in with something we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Disney's branching out their advertising, where they did the Scarlett Johansson, right, the Annie Leibovitz marketing. And I think that this too is something that maybe they could have reach a different level than may come to the theme parks. They can reach to a different audience, people who may not bring the children to the theme parks. They can bring that Disney quality to other experiences. I mean, Walt himself, when he did animated features, I've often heard them talk of how he, in some ways, I guess, longed to do something kind of outside of purely the family, family friendly,
right, no, true,
children oriented, yeah, stuff. Not that he didn't love that, and I don't want people to think that that's what I'm saying. But there's just something with teeth on it. Like Fantasia, I think, is an example of where kind of Walt branched out beyond what would
it's be. It's got teeth.
But it's just different. It's not you know, the story that you sit down and tell your kids by the bedside kind of thing.
And speaking of movies, on day two they had the rest of the divisions, you had ESPN and Media Networks. I'm not going to go into that because that's not what we really care about. But they had the studios talk, specifically Ed Catmull and John Lasseter talk about the upcoming slate. And I think it put to rest a lot of those sort of crazy rumors going out. Disney Feature Animation is not getting out of 3D, and it's not getting out of 2D. Yeah, fantastic. Toy Story 3 is in process. In fact, the famed writer who wrote Little Miss Sunshine, which is up for best animated picture, that's not true, best picture at the animated I just love animation. He's going to write the script based on an idea that was developed at Pixar.
And this is being done by Disney Feature Animation, not by Pixar.
No, it's being done by Pixar. And American Dog is being done, still in works. They've got a new animator who worked on Mulan, who's spearheading the direction of that. So there's that, everything's going forward. I wouldn't believe the sort of rash, both this is happening way that things are going about it. They're still, it's the mantras, right movie, right price. You look for a lot of franchise films, more Pirates, more Narnia.
Who did the film division presentation at the investors conference?
Well, it was mainly done by Orna Vive, who, as we know, did that classic Disney movie, National Treasure, who came up with the idea for that, as well as classic Disney movie Rocket Man. Dick Cook was not there. But I wouldn't brief too much into that because he was mentioned frequently. It wasn't like he was on the outs. I know last year, Ann Sweeney wasn't there. So not everyone makes this conference. But the thing that I find interesting is, why wasn't he there? Was there something big going on? Is there something we should be expecting to see in the next couple weeks?
President Dick Cook?
We can only hope.
I'm thinking more negotiations, like grabbing in a big name like Spielberg, working with,
Zemeckis.
My mind goes that way. Like, because like if this was a period when he would have been in talks with Bruckheimer regarding, back in the day when they were first talking about pirates, like something like that was happening.
I'm thinking big.
You're thinking like president.
I'm thinking number two at Disney.
If you go to Disney.com/investors, I'm sorry, the all new Disney.com/investors.
Does that URL work, by the way? THE, all new.
If it doesn't, it should. If anyone from Disney's reading it, DisneyCruiseLine.com should work in addition to DisneyCruise.com, because I'm tired of typing DisneyCruiseLine.com and getting a DNS error because the name of the property is Disney Cruise Line. Sorry, I'm just bitter.
URLs are quite expensive to register.
Someone at Disney just go to GoDaddy. but I was struck by how passionate the presenters were, from George Bodenheimer from ESPN, Rich Ross at Disney Channel Worldwide. And considering this was an investors conference, you're talking about the dollars and cents, folks.
Right.
It was all about creativity and passion and how that drives results. We made this movie and it only cost us $1 million. It was more like we made this movie, people loved it, and then we were able to extend it to hundreds of billions of dollars.
And it only cost $1 million.
Yeah. Well, what I find interesting, how much do you think High School Musical cost to make?
Like $7-8 million?
Oh, or four. And you look at $4 million that has now multiplied hundreds and hundreds of times over, and, they announced Haunted High School Musical will be distributed theatrically. So
imagine if they'd have spent $12 million, then you'd have made three times as much.
This is why you run a website.
That's harsh.
You got told there.
Fine. On that note, we are leaving the fanboy section of the podcast.
The very animated section.
And moving on to something else I know nothing about, which is The Incredibles, potentially at Disneyland, and The Three Caballeros. And we're going to get into that by playing one of our voicemails.
Hey, Laughing Place podcast crew. I just wanted to say that I love the show and everything. My name is Jason, by the way. So I was listening to your latest episode, and you were talking about the rumor of the People Mover coming back in the form of the Incredibles pods. And I had also read that rumor. And the first time that I read and heard about that rumor, it was that the new vehicles were going to be based on the design of the pods in the movie, The Incredibles. And I thought that was a really great idea because the pods were very futuristic, but at the same time it was keeping The Incredibles out of the picture. They were just taking the design because, I don't know about you, but I don't really see how The Incredibles fit in with Tomorrowland. And now this rumor is coming up that the ride is going to be based on The Incredibles, but be put in Tomorrowland. So, I don't know what Disney is thinking, because you'd think that with the flack that they've gotten from the online communities for the Monsters, Inc. Laugh-Floor Comedy Club not belonging in Tomorrowland, you wonder exactly what would possess them to put The Incredibles, of all characters, into Tomorrowland. So I really hope that they don't do this. What I hope that they do is bring back the People Mover and steal the design of the pods from the movie, but keep The Incredibles out of Tomorrowland. That's just what I feel would be the best thing. But that's what I'm thinking, and hopefully I'll hear your thoughts on it. So until then, bye.
Woohoo, that was exciting. Our first, reader feedback on the podcast. Wow.
And actually, I think they're listeners on the podcast.
Oh, fine. They are. Okay.
And we're crew.
Yeah, we got a name.
Crew.
Now we just need t-shirts.
See, I'm the captain. You're my crew.
Oh,
See, that's how it works.
I swabbed the deck. I already know that.
All right, but enough patting on the back. Let's get to what we actually talked about. What do you guys think? The Incredibles fit right into Tomorrowland, right?
Well, to me, I mean, I always found Buzz Lightyear, actually, to be honest, sort of odd because it's from Toy Story. Toy Story itself has no particular relevance to Tomorrowland either, but yet, you know, they sort of branched it out and made Buzz Lightyear. So it's just sort of like Pixar and Nemo and, you know.
But Buzz Lightyear is from Infinity and Beyond, which is in the future.
By definition.
Yeah.
It seems like just because Pixar by definition is tomorrow because it looks futuristic.
Well, they used futuristic technology in the movie, The Incredibles. You know, they got robots and stuff. So, I mean, it could work in that way. I mean, where else would they go is one of the questions.
Well, a little known fact, The Incredibles actually takes place in the year 2009. So it does take place in the future.
Does it really? Or are you making that up?
I made that up.
Yes.
Okay, because I was like, I don't remember that being any part of it.
But I remember when they opened A Bug's Land and people asked, what does this have to do with California? And
we have bugs
there's
in
bugs
California.
In California.
And, but John Lasseter replied that
Bug's Life takes place in California.
A Bug's Life was filmed entirely on location in Emeryville.
These are not good reasons for choosing a
line. Okay. Wait.
John,
I got to say
Captain
something.
Captain John's got something.
If I recall correctly, there was like this sing-along song video for Animal Kingdom, and Flick was the host, and he actually shows a passport which says Ant Island, California. So Ant Island is in California.
Who knew that sing-along songs were canon?
See,
we need to talk about exactly what is canon. But anyway, I think Rebecca had something.
Well, not really. I was just
all right. Well, then
I hadn't really thought about it. The caller, I mean, he brought up a point I hadn't considered because the Incredibles, because of exactly what you said. Since Incredibles is done in a futuristic style, because it's in a kind of a cutting edge technology, I didn't really think about the realities of where the story takes place, and so does it really fit in with a Tomorrowland image? And so I like the idea of the pods. I agree with that. And I always like the fact that Tomorrowland was not particularly character-driven. So I'm a little disappointed that that's where it appears that one more land is going to bite the dust in the character department.
So, Rebecca, what's your favorite Tomorrowland attraction of the past at Disneyland?
Well, that's not fair. It's America Sings. But that's not fair.
That's not character-driven.
Because it wasn't technically... I mean, seriously, it wasn't...
And it has to do with the future...
No, I agree with you.
No, she didn't say that. She said character-driven.
I agree with you that it wasn't... I agree with you that it wasn't futuristic. I mean, I'm totally there. But it didn't draw... It didn't take away from the overall environment. When I walked in Tomorrowland, I didn't know what was going inside the rotating building. The rotating building was pretty cool. You know, so it fit in that way. It wasn't until I went inside that it was totally wrong.
Well, now the buzz was that the part of the Incredibles attraction was going to take place in the rotating building, so it still would have been cool.
Oh, well.
See, here's one thing about the Incredibles is that when they did the whole new Tomorrowland thing, they sort of did this sort of retro future, which is sort of what The Incredibles is, because sort of like, you know, comic booky 60s retro sort of film, but then it's sort of combined with, you know, the whole robotics thing, so it's almost sort of like how Tomorrowland, the new Tomorrowland as it is.
Well, the thing that bothers me, because, you know, we're Disney fans, we have to be bothered, it's not the fitting of the attraction of the land, it's the characters, as Rebecca also mentioned, because it just seems to me that way too many attractions and way too many parks or areas of parks are getting too driven by the films, which is kind of stupid because, you know, Disneyland was built on making attractions based on films, but I liked that Epcot pretty much did not have attractions based on characters. I think that was a good thing, which brings, you know, one of the next subjects up, which is the three Caballeros being added to the Mexico Pavilion at Epcot, and everything I hear so far sounds good, and I'm sure the attraction will be fun and even be more popular, but it saddens me that one more part of a park is now going to have characters instead of just, you know, being on its own. And I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I like the fact that Epcot was not character-driven, and I'm not liking the trend towards everything being character-driven.
I'm wondering if that's... I mean, I suspect it's audience-driven. I don't know from, you know, I'm not on the committee that gathers information from Disney World guests. But it seems that maybe they deal with disappointment when there isn't characters, that people come to the Disney theme parks expecting characters, and that's something that's happened over the years. I don't know, you know, I don't know if that's what people envisioned when they used to go to Disney World in the 50s, Disneyland in the 50s and 60s. Was it, you know, was the main goal of, you know, meet Mickey Mouse, Snow White? Is that what specifically drove them there, or was it more the theme park and dark ride and just that kind of stuff, and the Disney element was the added touch, whereas now the goal is, I mean, you look at the lines for the characters, they're huge.
But there's plenty of places to meet characters. I'm not against characters by any stretch of the imagination. I love the characters in the parks. I just also love the parts of the parks that don't have the characters. I don't think anyone's going to, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think anyone's going to come to Disney World and go, we didn't see enough characters while we were here.
And I think you're wrong. And
shocking.
No, because I know that they had that problem when they opened Epcot. There were no characters, so they kind of shoved them everywhere. Or when they opened DCA, there was no characters, so they shoved them everywhere. Playmosphere, Minnie Earhart, that kind of stuff. And that's why when they built Animal Kingdom, they made Camp Minnie Mickey, not because they thought it was integral to the Animal Kingdom story, but they knew if they didn't have a place for characters, they'd be in trouble. And I know that there's a movement to sort of having them in specific areas. But at Epcot, there is no real area. They're building character connection, or the new character connection, I think it's called Character Spot, so that there'll be a central area for meet and greets. But there's not a lot of character attractions, just Nemo,
Circle of Life,
and Ellen.
I know there's not a lot, but the ones that there are, the vast majority of them have come recently. And that's what bothered me.
But not to mention before, Epcot sort of had its own characters, too. He had, like, Figment and stuff like that.
And that little robot guy, whose name I don't know.
Tom Morrow?
No. He was way back when. I was visiting this website of a passionate Epcot fan, and he has all this merchandise from the past, and I'm so sorry, I've forgotten the URL. But he has Epcot merchandise of the past, and in it there was a little picture of this little robot guy who was probably in the Communicore area. And they had little merchandise featuring him and stuff, too. And he looked really cute. So I was, like, bummed that he's not there
anymore. I'm sure Disney is doing what they need to do to please the guests. So I'm not going to say it's a bad business move. I'm just saying it saddens me.
Well, and I think if they were completely redoing the Mexico Boat Ride and they had a reason to make it a new attraction, something fantastic, they would do it. With Soarin', there's no character. I mean, Tinkerbell at the end, but that's not
that doesn't count.
Well, that's using as a crutch the fact that nobody goes on the silly thing and nobody likes it. It's not a huge redo. I think everyone's wrong today.
I know what you're saying. It's depressing. Not depressing. That's an overstatement. But it saddens me that an attraction's not working well. Add a character. Now it's popular. Well, I would rather I know it's Blue Sky. I'd rather them make a better attraction.
I don't disagree with that, but I agree. But I also think that Epcot hasn't had a shortage of big new attractions lately, whether we like them or not. I mean, you had Mission Space, you had Soarin', you had Test Track
Still not out of Fox opening, right?
No. You're not going to go and see big extravagant promotion regarding this new attraction. This is just something to sort of get by until they can do something they really want to do.
But here's the one thing is that the World Showcase area as it is was always just like the really big focus. It's like now you can see what it's like to visit this country. So now that they're sort of plaguing these countries with random Disney characters may actually do the opposite effect to some people. It's like, hey, I wanted to see Mexico as Mexico, not as the Disney.
I think that's actually a very good point.
Thing.
I would love, I mean, you're never going to hear this, but I'd love to hear what the cast members from the country in Mexico think about the new version of the attraction.
Can go find Oscar on the Disney Cruise Line and ask him. I know he used to work at the Epcot Pavilion.
Mexico Pavilion.
And it's, you know, I mean, and one funny thing, I mean, this is sort of off topic, but one funny thing I heard in the park, and I'm not kidding, I actually heard this, was some guest heard a rumor that they're adding the three caballeros to the Mexico Boat Ride, and they asked why Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Chevy Chase were going to be added. And I know Steve Martin's a Disney legend. Don't get me wrong. I mean, worked at the Magic Shop on Main Street. But and
wherever there is strife, we are there.
So, and, you know, the movie did feature music from Randy Newman.
Do-de-do-do-do. And on that, the other thing our voicemailer mentioned, that's very interesting to some of the people here is Monsters, Inc. Laugh Floor, which Rebecca and I finally got to see at the media event a couple weeks ago.
You know what's interesting? You laughed more then than you did when you saw the show.
Fanboy gave us his opinions a few podcasts ago. Captain John, unfortunately, hasn't seen it yet.
So. I never see anything. See, I think this goes on with the tradition. I don't know why I'm here.
We know why you're here. You've got the headphones on. And but Rebecca, what did you think of Monsters, Inc. Laugh Floor? Be kind.
I honestly, I left there kind of not really knowing what to say because I wanted to like it because it was something new and everything, but it's the first time, I think it's the first time, I couldn't think of anything else, where I just felt like something was totally driven by a specific trick. It was like, here, we've learned that we can interact with our guests via text messaging. What can we, and we have these live character things that, you know, from Turtle Talk and Stitch, you know, what can we do with it? Oh, let's throw some monsters in. But I mean, I know that's honestly not what happens. I'm getting looks from the people at the table, let me just say. But I know that people work very hard on it, so that's why it's difficult for me sometimes to criticize because I have not worked on it at all. Go ahead. I don't know what to say.
I understand. I mean, you know, people work hard on attractions and have high hopes for them, and who knows? It's not open yet. It may turn out to be wonderful, but based on what we saw a couple of weeks ago, it was not an entertaining attraction, to say the least.
I looked at the discussion boards to see if, you know, if other people felt the same way I did or, you know, if they were torn or how people felt. And I think it's Phoenix. I think that's how they say that screen name. Called it a total mess. Said, started off, what a total mess. There's hardly anything redeeming about this fiasco at all. And it's just, it's sad to see those lines when you're talking about an upcoming Disney attraction. I don't know.
I think another poster, I was reading that same discussion board, strangely enough, and
yeah,
another poster really summed up the basic problem I thought the attraction had. He said it failed miserably because no one laughed at the bad jokes.
Sort of like this podcast.
No, see, for me, I'm...
That's a good point.
I wasn't sure regarding its success because we were there with a bunch of media people. And so mostly we were there, we were surrounded by people who were there to watch and record, in essence, what they were experiencing. And this is really an attraction that's meant to be interactive, that's meant to be, you know, the audience involvement is really important, I think, to this attraction, which is why I'm concerned about its success overall. In talking with some friends who have been Jungle Cruise skippers, you know, they shared how difficult it is sometimes. You get a boat, sometimes the people, your jokes aren't that great that day, you're not really on your mark, but people laugh hysterically, whereas other times, you could be having your A game, your boat that you just got, was laughing hysterically. Now you've got this new boat of people and nobody's laughing.
Right.
And I mean, if it's a something that's, the whole storyline is built on the concept of laughter, which is why I thought Sean Yoda posted what he thought could fix the problem. And I thought he came up with some really good ideas. He talked about abandoning the storyline to not have it be based on the concept of building laughter. So that way, if the audience isn't necessarily finding the overall show terribly funny, your storyline isn't totally screwed up.
I think that is the basic problem. It's the whole attraction is based on you're going to a comedy club. And it's great when you get comedy from Rex on Star Tours or in the Jungle Cruise where that's a part of the experience. But that is the experience here. And when that's the experience, you better be funny. And it's kind of hard to be funny for adults and children at Disney with internationals and, you know, small crowds sometimes. And it's not that easy to be funny. I think it's kind of a real challenge they've given themselves.
And and just one more post before you go on, Fanboy. I thought Gergi Toy 2 pointed out something interesting. I
know he tends to.
He's got the munchies and the crunchies.
For him, I say him. I don't know the gender of the poster. Sorry about that, Gergi.
Does anyone know the gender of Gergi?
Hey, I'm not so sure everybody even knows who Gergi is.
Who is Gergi?
From the Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron.
Disney animated
Cauldron.
Feature number.
No, me. I know who he is. I'm trying to help out.
Oh,
some
I'm
of
sorry.
Our...
He's the one who always says no smackings and whackings. He talks about it's not just the interactivity that he's concerned about. It's the overstimulation. He's talking about how more and more attractions seem to be throwing you into an experience where you have to get involved and be active in it. And sometimes on vacation, you're on vacation, you want to relax.
Yeah, chill.
What happened to the passive experiences like It's a Small World where you're in a boat and you're experiencing the attraction, or Pirates where you're in a boat and you're the pirates don't jump in the boat with you. Although some people may prefer that they do, especially considering the new Johnny Depp figure, but that's another story.
Backside of Rebecca.
Autobiography.
No, no, I'm not a Johnny Depp fan, but I've heard the ladies' comments as we're riding through that attraction.
Like plastic.
You know what?
There are some very fascinating stories about that last figure at the end of that attraction.
Yeah.
Where he's sitting in the chair. Yeah, people have thrown clothes at him.
That's disgusting.
It is disgusting, but I find it incredibly funny.
Do they give it to, like, neat charities like they do the coins?
I think it would depend on
all the panties have been donated to make a wish.
Oh, that's disturbing.
The podcast.
That's very disturbing.
Jump the shark. Let's see if we can jump back. Moving on to we said everything we need to say about Laugh Floor.
Apparently we're laughing more than we would have in the attraction going by.
Fanboy, did you have any?
I've seen Turtle Talk a bunch of times, and I think that the failure of Laugh Floor really makes Turtle Talk look better, because it's just a simple living character thing, but you realize that that's not enough. And I think the folks that worked on Turtle Talk, it might be the same people that worked on Monsters, Inc. I have no idea, but it's fantastic, and I think they should deserve some credit.
I just want to, before we move on to the next topic, because I know Doobie's eager to move on.
No, I'm not. I got all day.
Okay. Just, I guess, as a clarification or whatever, the show still is in previews.
Right.
So by the time it opens, we could see something totally different than what we're seeing now. I know that we do for theatrical presentations. And so, you know, this is all based on the current previews. So,
absolutely.
So once the doors open on, opening day, as it were, I'll go in slate clean and give it a shot
I can speak for us all. We certainly hope that what we see on opening day is a wonderful attraction. We're not sitting here hoping Disney fails. We just are speaking on what we've seen so far.
And I haven't seen anything, so I've got my hopes up.
So you're going to give us the review once it actually opens.
I'll be like,
you're the only pure brain here.
Yes. I'm the innocent one.
We're going to move on to one of my favorite subjects. Rebecca could attest that I absolutely love fantasy movies.
He fell asleep during both Harry Potters. He's been dragged to.
It was not sleep, though. It was
and Pirates of the Caribbean 2, which is sort of a fantasy movie.
We were just talking about that. Olestra? Is that what?
Not Olestra. Lunestra. That should sponsor Pirates 3 because it helps you go to bed.
Lunestra.
Yeah.
Olestra is a fat substitute that gives you diarrhea. So that's a whole different thing. Nope, don't go there.
Well, we were talking about the Black Cauldron earlier.
Narnia. There's some exciting news in the world of Narnia this week.
Only 6 weeks of this next Narnia film, Prince Caspian, will be filmed in New Zealand. Unlike the other one where they had some difficulties filming in that location.
Right.
For the start and the end of the film takes place in New Zealand, then they'll be going back to sound stages in Europe to film the rest of the film.
And that's information from the director, Andrew Adamson, who, of course, was talking about the beginning of filming of the sequel, which is called
Prince Caspian.
How exciting.
Or Walt Disney Pictures and Walt Media present The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian.
And Mr. Adamson also said that he will not be directing the third installment, which is called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader?
Yes, yep. Sir.
Mm-hmm. For a very good reason. He's still going to be doing the second one when the third one begins production.
You know, another related story that kind of flew under radar is that's why the director of Underdog will not be directing Underdog 2, is Underdog 1 will still be in production when Underdog 2 starts. Huh. One Nation Underdog.
Oh, wow.
Are there any other movies? Series like that where they just sort of like start making movies at the same time.
No, I've seen.
Unfortunately, Pirates of the Caribbean.
No, but they did that in order. It's the same director for both of them.
I think Back to the Future filmed 2 and 3 sort of simultaneously, but
with different people.
No, with the same people. Just, you know, take advantage of a set or whatever and do both scenes from 2 and 3.
But I'm saying that this is weird. Sort of odd.
This is weird. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, this is weird.
You know what else?
How close together were the Potter films done?
They have months between. Yeah. Okay. In some cases, like for between 2 and 3, there's like a whole year.
Were there different directors on those films?
Yes, but for different reasons. Okay. Besides.
Well, also, if I remember correctly, Voyage of Dawn Treader has a different cast for the majority of the film than the Narnia and Narnia, the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe and Prince Caspian, so or even Pirates or Back to the Future, so they can do them simultaneously and not require the same.
But
actors.
the thing that's odd is just the director, though, because when you've got a series of films, you sort of want to stay with the same director, you sort of get the same flow.
I'm sure if it was he was heart set on filming the entire 7-book series, he'd be able to. I think he also, I mean, I remember when they weren't sure he was going to do the second one. So I don't know that this is necessarily the sole reason.
Right.
It's just fascinating. It's I just thought I'd talk about it.
You know what else is fascinating? In doing some research for this piece, I discovered, like no one else had ever seen this before, Pirates of the Caribbean, which is obviously the Disney franchise, had a $46 million opening weekend. Chronicles of Narnia, which is the other franchise, had a $65 million opening weekend. And I just find that interesting. Narnia doesn't get nearly the play Pirates did. Maybe
I think we realized the problem with the Pirate Princess Party. It should have been the Narnia Princess Party.
With the real live, what's his name, Azkaban?
Aslan.
Azkaban is the Potter prison.
Well, you're going to get sued for that one.
Dude, I'm sorry. That was not intentional. Okay. I had a name issue.
No, but it makes me think that, for Narnia, there was actually some people waiting for it. Pirates of the Caribbean was one of those weird sort of
It had no expectations.
Things.
After Country Bear and Haunted Mansion, people were pirates. Yeah, right.
So,
Rebecca, you were going to...
I was going to say, Disney opened the Narnia film on 3,616 theaters, while Pirates opening weekend was at 3,269 theaters. So I'm interested. Yeah, no, I'm fascinated to see that Narnia opened on more screens, but Narnia did a greater per screen average on opening weekend than
Pirates. Also, Pirates opened during the more crowded summer season. I remember that year there was also a bunch of blockbusters, so there probably weren't as many screens available.
I'm sure. I still think it's interesting. I mean, I don't expect Narnia 2 to do anywhere near Pirates 2, but...
But do you expect it to do nearly as well as the first film?
I do. Assuming it's a decent film like the first one was, I do. But I just think it's interesting. I don't think most people, at least the Disney fans I think of, Pirates is foremost in their mind as the Disney franchise, and Narnia is... hardly in anyone's consciousness in that respect, and it should be.
And I think Disney might have not done as well as expanding the franchise as they could have, possibly because they don't know there's author rights and
stuff
like that.
Now they built a whole attraction around the Pirates movie, didn't they?
Yeah, and I mean, well, they did one with Narnia too. It's basically a glorified trailer. And so, you look, there was a lot of little girls dressed up as Lucy from the movie for Halloween. A lot of folks are quite frankly disappointed with the attraction because they want to see a Narnia attraction,
yes,
and they see a trailer.
I hear that a lot when we're walking through MGM Studios, people coming out of the saying, "Wow, that was pretty much just a trailer."
So I just hope with the success of Pirates, Disney's not forgetting they have another real success here as well, and maybe gets a little more play in various areas of the Disney company, and maybe there's another film that comes out today as this podcast is released. That might even be a third franchise, though. I'm not sure the book even has a sequel, so probably not.
No. And
although, to me, it feels like Narnia 1.5, because one fantasy movie is like another. And that's The Bridge to Terabithia?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
I always have pronunciation issues.
That's why it's great that you're our host.
You are harsh today, fanboy.
I'm hungry.
And in checking out Rotten Tomatoes today, it's off to a good start. It's only 12 reviews in, but it's doing 83%. Anybody excited about this one?
I am very much excited. Woohoo!
As a random note to sort of go off topic, this is yet another movie where people are predicting for a Pirates 3 trailer to appear. Everybody has predicted a different movie for Pirates 3 to appear to the point where somebody's going to have to be right eventually.
I can almost guarantee a Pirates 3 trailer will not premiere with this movie because I believe the trailer attached to this movie is actually Underdog, which can be seen on the all-new Disney.com.
I know that Dave, one of our crew out in California, really enjoyed this film. He had the chance to see it in preview a couple of weeks back, and he came out of it telling us that we had to put it on our must-see list of films. And he's one of those, old-fashioned guy
kind
don't
heart
cry.
Of stone.
Yeah, men don't cry kind of guys. And he told me to be sure to bring tissues. So apparently this movie can be quite heartstrings.
That this is the most anticipated movie on the 2007 Disney slate. And if you believe that, I got a bridge to Terabithia to sell you.
Oh, dear. That's painful.
Homie, you did not just
that. That was so painful.
Hey, you know, we got to have something to talk about this movie we haven't seen.
And as a fan of the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie, I recognize the leading actress who plays Violet Beauregard in that movie. So it's good to see that she's getting somewhere.
This movie opens up this weekend against the thriller Breach, the comic book movie Ghost Rider, and Music and Lyrics and Daddy's Little Girl, both of which opened actually on Valentine's Day. Where does this finish this weekend? 1, 2, 3, not even in the running. Give me a quick answer. Captain John.
4.
Whew, that wouldn't be good.
I say 3.
I would also say 3.
I think this is going to open number 1.
Really?
Looking at the competition. And what's number 1 right now? Norbit? I think this is going
to
open.
Well, I don't know. They're expecting that to have a strong second week.
You know, Bridge.
Because based on its Rotten Tomatoes score of 6, I believe.
Well, I just think that the advertising for it has been next to non-existent. So I don't think, unless you are already, you know, gearing up for it, you're not going to know it exists.
Well, for some behind-the-scenes drama, I know that Walden Media, which did Narnia, is also doing this movie. And I think I mentioned this in the past. They've actually set up a studio with Fox. So I don't know if the relationship is as strong as it might have been in the past, right, especially after the complete disaster of Around the World in 80 Days. So I don't know if Disney's sights are held high. It's a typical Disney February movie. If it does $60 million, Disney will be happy because they can show it.
When you say a typical Disney February movie, can you give me some...
Jungle Book 2.
Okay.
Oh, was that when Return to Neverland came out?
Yes.
With the best Disney song ever?
We need some feedback.
Great Big Beautiful
on that
Tomorrow
one
was not in that, was it?
You got to tell us what is the best Disney theme song or just best Disney song in the
movie. I'll try.
Yes, please.
No, please tell
Doobie
us.
Doobie wrong. Call us, email us. Let us know that Doobie needs to be corrected.
See, we're
on
teams now. It seems like Rebecca and I and Doobie and Fanboy.
You with me on this one, Fanboy?
No. although I know that you can hear songs from Bridge to Terabithia on Radio Disney.
Which is sung by
is
the person
in the movie.
Is it done
by Hayden? I think one of the songs from this is done by Hayden Panettiere. You know, save the cheerleader, save the world.
There's a song sung by the whatever her name is who plays the person
Hayden
in the film.
Yeah, I think and the one that I keep getting play is the one from
on Disney Channel. Yeah.
Who sings it?
The actress who's in the movie, the blonde chick.
Oh, that's right. I saw a movie.
I don't actually know her name.
I saw one of those Disney movie surfer things interviewing her, and she was talking about how she was singing for the first time.
Like Lindsay Lohan sang in Herbie 2.
Disney likes to do that. Uh-huh. Have their stars also cross over into music.
You know, at the Disney Investor Conference, we've learned that the Walt Disney Records label is the most envied in the industry because they're able to cross-pollinate like that.
And then Bob Iger sang a song, right?
Yes, about the weather, I believe.
And for those of you who don't know, apparently Bob Iger in his younger days was a weatherman in the upstate New York area.
And we've scoured YouTube and have yet to find any footage, so if anyone has any of that, please let us know.
We know,
because
there's
we know
some,
everything is on YouTube.
We know there's some out there because I think it was Ithaca. He gave a presentation at the local at the university there, and they showed apparently some footage of him as a weatherman. So we know somewhere out there it must exist, but we have yet to see it.
So yes, no, he wasn't in the movie The Weatherman. That's something entirely different.
But wasn't that the movie with Nicolas Cage?
No, you're thinking of The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
There we go.
Okay. Well, we'll save that for next week.
Is he Mickey Mouse or Dopey?
Isn't he the conductor? What's
Jensen?
His name?
Jensen? Oh, no. Leopold. The
Mr. Stokowski! Mr. Stokowski!
Oh, that was spot on. Wayne.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, we're going to move on to a whole new subject. We're going to touch on the Disney Channel.
A whole new subject. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Try harder next time.
What?
Sorry, Fan. No, you're not Fan.
I'm
sorry,
not Fan Boy.
Hey. I would never do something that silly.
You would never sing. By the way, thank you for being our theme. The Disney Channel, Kim Possible, made its triumphant return last week, and we actually got some voicemail about that, so here we go.
Hey, I wanted to ask you guys if you watched the Kim Possible 4th season premiere this past weekend. Now, I know the Disney Channel events are not usually one of the things you discuss, but in this particular case, I think it's pretty special. And maybe somewhat important for Disney Animation, at least for the television division, because of viewers' efforts to extend the show and not being successful. And I'm sure Will Friedle is happy for every episode that puts one more day between him and my date with the president's daughter. Just thinking about that show cracks me up. It's not that it was so bad of a movie as they go, I guess, but that song, that title song, my goodness, I have no idea whoever greenlit that thing. Anyway, not to digress too far. So what do you think about the fourth season for KP? Is this score one for the good guys? We get to enjoy a witty, entertaining, family-friendly show one more time around? Or has the show jumped? Having watched the first four episodes and without taking any time to really explain to you why I feel this way, I think the writers haven't yet found a good focus for this last season. Now, I realize that this discussion is perhaps moot. I don't know what the production schedule is, but most of the episodes are probably already in the can. So if that's true, I hope they did finally sort everything out. But right now it seems like they're trying to go three different ways at once, with all the sub-stories involving my new villain, Wade, and the Tweebs. Anyway, I'll hand it over to you guys now. Just as one parting note, these episodes were all written with an additional scene during the credits. I guess you call that a stinger. But Disney Channel typically has these annoying voiceovers during the credits to advertise upcoming content with really, really dumb writing. Anyway, after the first episode, the voiceover stepped on the stinger. Now, how's that for an image, yeah? I'm sure the phones lit up at the control room on that one, because the credit voiceovers were squelched for the remaining three episodes. It's fun to catch the screw-ups now and again. All right, see ya.
I agree with 90% of what he said. This is score one for the good guys. Disney Channel used to only make 65 episodes. In fact, Kim Possible released a movie, So the Drama, that wrapped everything up, and I think that's part of the reason why this season four is different. Kim is dating Ron, and normally that would just keep going on and never have come to or be a reality. So it has changed. The dweebs are out in high school. Tweebs, because they're twin dweebs. Kim's driving. It's cool. In fact, I totally agree with the stinger comment. They made an awesome joke about how Kim Possible jumped the shark that you couldn't hear, because they were talking about an all-new exciting episode of Cory in the House. So, but I disagree in that I thought the direction is different this season, but I thought it was a lot of fun. That was some good 2 hours of Kim Possible. The weird thing is those episodes were not aired in production order, so it would be interesting to see if you did watch them in production order. Maybe it would make more sense, because I know they want to get the Valentine's Day episode in, probably because it was right before Valentine's Day.
Right. I believe we saw Kim driving her tricked out car when we never saw her get the car, and I presume that we'll see that earlier on. In reading up on Kim Possible, I didn't realize somehow I missed the whole push for, you know, changing Disney.com's Disney Channel 65 episodes policy. There's actually a website out there called SaveDisneyShows.org, and they were formed to specifically seek action in Disney formally abolishing their 65 episode policy. And they have a lot of Kim Possible information, and they were and then they also really wish to see a return to more shows that were more popular, like Rescue Rangers and DuckTales. They'd like to see better treatment of those. I know people have been disappointed up until recently, the availability with DVD or whatnot, and I know that that's changed recently, and they acknowledge that as well. In looking at the ratings, it appears that Kim Possible Saturday Night, it was seventh in the overall. They have the list I saw had like SpongeBob and then Fairly Odd Parents and then another SpongeBob and, you know, so not a lot of Nickelodeon shows, and then Kim Possible was seventh in the numbers there. I enjoyed what I saw. The SaveDisneyShows.org also, they were interviewed the director, Steve Loader, and right after the day after the premiere. And he addressed some of the stuff that was brought up by the caller, the fact of the direction of the show having to kind of change a bit because of the hookup. I think it was there I read it. I also read a report on bloggingbaby.com where they interviewed Mark, I think it was Mark McCorkle and Bob Schuele. They talked to them about the show, and I don't remember which of those interviews, but they talked about how they've kind of, in some ways, they painted themselves into a corner, as Fanboy pointed out, where the Ron and Kim have, you know, hooked up now. They're boyfriend, girlfriend. And before, you always had kind of that little, like, dance around each other. Well, now they are a couple. And you don't want to turn this into, you know, One Tree Hill or, you know, something like, you know,
a
teen drama kind
Wildfire,
of kind of situation. So they have to think up other ways. They're going to have to think up other ways to deal with the realities of Kim having a boyfriend. They touched on possibly some interaction. I know, huh? They'll see some interaction with Kim's dad now that Ron's the boyfriend. Maybe a little bit of, you know, how's the dad react, or touch on that, and a couple of things like that they've talked about. They also, I guess, they also talk about how they're going to deal with this indestructible suit. And I guess they've had to make some changes because they realized some of the difficulties that presented as far as challenging storylines to have this indestructible suit.
I've got a question. Does the Save Disney Channel shows.org have anything about Dave the Barbarian?
I didn't see anything about Dave the Barbarian on SaveDisneyShows.org. But based on some of the stuff I have read, I doubt it's on their high list of programming to save. I don't think that one scores real well with the SaveDisneyShows.org crowd. But if any of you are listening, you can write Fanboy and let him know what you think of Dave the Barbarian.
It was interesting listening to this investor conference, going back to that, because a couple years ago, it was all about creating animated shows, and that was the key to Disney Channel. They did The Buzz on Maggie, which is now on Cartoon Network, and the Brandy and Mr. Whiskers and Dave the Barbarian, and when none of that stick, they just went back to Kim Possible and live action shows. So it was neat to see sort of a direction.
One of the interesting things that I read with Blogging Baby was Bob and Mark talking about animation, and it was something that I hadn't really thought of in regards to the current Disney Channel programming. But he was saying Bob and Mark both started with Deke Studios, and they were talking. They were talking about how Bob talked about how he worked on Super Mario Brothers Super Show back in the late 80s.
Do the Mario.
And he described it as unwatchable. Bad dialogue, bad puns. He said the worst cartoon today. But he said the worst cartoon today is light years ahead of what we used to have. And then Mark talked about how he really feels that a quality shift started when Disney did DuckTales. Ooh. And then Warner Brothers responded with Batman, which raised the bar again.
Oh, yeah.
And so they both seem to talk about the new animation age as for, you know, daytime animation. I guess that's the best way to describe it. As just
that
the
animation of, like, sexy women and illustrious affairs.
But the TV and animation, TV animation is at a good level. You know, the bar's been raised.
It is. I don't watch it that much, but when I do, I invariably laugh a lot. It's pretty entertaining.
I remember when we watched The Replacements, the newest animated show.
Okay, invariably may be a strong word to use. I laugh a lot.
But even if I don't necessarily enjoy the storylines, I have to admit The Replacements didn't connect with me. It's not my type of humor and story and whatnot. But
did they replace it?
it got picked up for a second season.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
It's apparently doing well in a very focused age group market. I forget.
I remember
what
when
that
I was in college, The Replacements were a very popular band. Maybe this is hitting that same demographic.
They should have some cameo.
Hey,
when you were in college, was there a popular band called Dave the Barbarian?
No.
That might be the problem.
They were there. No, they just weren't that popular.
No, David the Barbarian was the stand-up comic that nobody liked.
That was me, actually. So now I have a podcast.
Who did the Dave the Barbarian theme song? Didn't they get some, like, big name to do the Dave the Barbarian theme song?
I hope not.
Because all he went is,
like,
Dave the Barbarian.
Oh, see,
if only there was a place.
Now I have to Google that.
Before we close this week, I do want to mention the passing of one of the all-time Disney legends, Peter Ellenshaw. He passed away at the age of 93 this past Monday, February 12th. Ellenshaw is an Oscar-winning visual effects pioneer and a matte artist, and he worked on films including Mary Poppins, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Darby O'Gill, and The Little People, Treasure Island, and The Black Hole. He is definitely one of the greats, and he will be missed by all Disney fans. So thank you once again for tuning in to the Laughing Place podcast. We love having you here. We always want to hear from you. You can reach us at podcast@laughingplace.com. You can post a message on the discussion boards, or you can give us a call, toll-free, 866-718-9408. That's 866-718-9408. Don't forget to let us know what the best Disney attraction of all time is, in your opinion.
And the best song.
And let me know that I'll Try is the best song. I know I don't need any help with that. I'm sure of that already, but, you know, I appreciate the feedback.
Let us know how wrong Doobie is.
And if you happen to see Bridge of Terabithia this weekend, go ahead and let us know what you think of that as well. Any final words, fanboy?
If anyone's going out to the meeting in New Orleans, let us know. We'd love to hook up with you.
Captain?
No comment.
Rebecca?
Oh, I just wanted to say have a great week. And the song I was thinking of was American Dragon. The Jonas Brothers performed it. So that's why I was thinking of.
As a special treat, we're going to sign off today with the original version of the Laughing Place podcast theme song. We'll see you next week. Should have seen the Secret Service agent's eyes.